something to his pupils. He had almost finished when he turned to one of the boys with the question, "Did you understand me?" The boy cried out like one possessed, "Ja!" Annoyed at this, he reprimanded him for shouting. But now the entire class was screaming, "Urja!" Then, "Urjo!" And finally, "Furjo!" He was now aroused by an actual alarm of fire in the street. Garnier, Traité des Facultés de l'Âme, 1865, reported by Radostock, relates that Napoleon I, while sleeping in a carriage, was awakened from a dream by an explosion, which brought back to him the crossing of the Tagliamento and the bombarding of the Austrians, so that he started up crying, "We are undermined!" The following dream of Maury has become celebrated. He was sick and remained in bed. His mother sat beside him. He then dreamed of the Reign of Terror at the time of the Revolution. He took part in terrible scenes of murder, and finally he himself was summoned before the tribunal. There he saw Robespierre, Marat, Fouquier-Tinville, and all the sorry heroes of that cruel epoch. He had to give an account of himself, and after all sorts of incidents which did not fix themselves in his memory, he was sentenced to death. Accompanied by an enormous crowd, he was led to the place of execution. He mounted the scaffold. The executioner tied him to the board, it tipped, and the knife of the guillotine fell. He felt his head severed from the trunk, and awakened in terrible anxiety, only to find that the top piece of the bed had fallen down, and had actually struck his cervical vertebra in the same manner as the knife of a guillotine. This dream gave rise to an interesting discussion introduced by Le Lorrain and Egger in the Revue Philosophique. The question was whether and how it was possible for the dreamer to crowd together an amount of dream content, apparently so large, in the short space of time elapsing between the perception of the waking stimulus and the awakening. Examples of this nature make it appear that the objective stimuli during sleep are the most firmly established of all the dream sources. Indeed, it is the only stimulus which plays any part in the layman's knowledge. If we ask an educated person who is, however, unacquainted with the literature of dreams, how dreams originate, he is sure to answer by referring to a case familiar to him in which a dream has been explained after waking by a recognized objective stimulus. Scientific investigation cannot, however, stop here, but is incited to further research by the observation that the stimulus influencing the senses during sleep does not appear in the dream at all in its true form, but is replaced by some other presentation which is in some way related to it. But the relation existing between the stimulus and the result of the dream is, according to Maury,
une affinité quelconque, mais qui n'est pas unique et exclusive.
Page 72. If we read, e.g., three of Hildebrandt's alarm clock dreams, we will then have to inquire why the same stimulus evoked so many different results, and why just these results and no others. Page 37. I am taking a walk on a beautiful spring morning. I saunter through the green fields to a neighbouring village, where I see the natives going to church in great numbers, wearing their holiday attire and carrying their hymn books under their arms. I remember that it is Sunday, and that the morning service will soon begin. I decide to attend it, but as I am somewhat overheated, I also decide to cool off in the cemetery surrounding the church. While reading the various epitaphs, I hear the sexton ascend the tower, and see the small village bell in the cupola, which is about to give signal for the beginning of the devotions. For another short while it hangs motionless, then it begins to swing, and suddenly its notes resound so clearly and penetratingly that my sleep comes to an end. But the sound of bells comes from the alarm clock. A second combination. It is a clear day. The streets are covered with deep snow. I have promised to take part in a sleigh ride, but have had to wait for some time before it was announced that the sleigh is in front of my house. The preparations for getting into the sleigh are now made. I put on my furs and adjust my muff, and at last I am in my place. But the departure is still delayed, until the reins give the impatient horses the perceptible sign. They start, and the sleigh bells, now forcibly shaken, begin their familiar Janissary music with a force that instantly tears the gossamer of my dream. Again it is only the shrill sound of my alarm clock. Still a third example. I see the kitchen maid walk along the corridor to the dining room with several dozen plates piled up. The porcelain column in her arms seems to me to be in danger of losing its equilibrium. "Take care," I exclaim, "you will drop the whole pile." The usual retort is naturally not wanting, that she is used to such things. Meanwhile, I continue to follow her with my worried glance, and behold, at the doorstep the fragile dishes fall, tumble, and roll across the floor in hundreds of pieces. But I soon notice that the noise continuing endlessly is not really a rattling, but a true ringing. And with this ringing, the dreamer now becomes aware that the alarm clock has done its duty. The question why the dreaming mind misjudges the nature of the objective sensory stimulus has been answered by Strumpel, and almost identically by Wundt, to the effect that the reaction of the mind to the attacking stimuli in sleep is determined by the formation of illusions. A sensory impression is recognized by us and correctly interpreted, i.e., it is classed with the memory group to which it belongs according to all previous experience, if the impression is strong, clear, and long enough, and if we have the necessary time at our disposal for this reflection. If these conditions are not fulfilled, we mistake the objects which give rise to the impression, and on its basis we form an illusion. If one takes a walk in an open field and perceives indistinctly a distant object, it may happen that he will at first take it for a horse. On closer inspection, the image of a cow resting may obtrude itself, and the presentation may finally resolve itself with certainty into a group of people sitting. The impressions which the mind receives during sleep through outer stimuli are of a similar indistinct nature. They give rise to illusions because the impression evokes a greater or lesser number of memory pictures through which the impression receives its psychic value. In which of the many spheres of memory to be taken into consideration the corresponding pictures are aroused, and which of the possible association connections thereby come into force, this, even according to Strumpel, remains indeterminable, and is left, as it were, to the caprice of the psychic life. We may here take our choice. We may admit that the laws of the dream formation cannot really be traced any further, and therefore refrain from asking whether or not the interpretation of the illusion evoked by the sensory impression depends upon still other conditions. Or we may suppose that the objective sensory stimulus encroaching upon sleep plays only a modest part as a dream source, and that other factors determine the choice of the memory.